to spend a couple moments on sort of a synopsis of what has happened. And as I indicated earlier, there were some things that we were able to do. And I suspect when you look back and reflect on things, and it's a very right occasion for that, is that you hope in your research career that you can make some progress in understanding science in a direct sense. But that's probably minimal in a university environment as far as an individual is concerned, because it's the students that end up being the multipliers. And if they're motivated and they can make those contributions, that is much more rewarding than having them yourself. And the other thing that has been very interesting to me today is to see the stimulation of others to move, to take some of the ideas and the foundations and expand them way beyond what I could have done or what my students and I could have done in our labs. But it recognizes in some ways the importance of the topics and the way that it's framed so that it can be important. It's interesting, as I look back, and I put these books up there because I've got involvement in them. One of the keys that I'm very interested in is getting this translated into something that can be useful on the farm or in another agricultural use, say for environmental preservation or other issues. And perhaps that's a more challenging task and one that I have still left to do. So we're going to see what we can do about getting some of these things translated into reality in the next few years as we continue to digest and transform all of this meaningful data into some practical applications. I'll point out a few. I was intrigued as I listened to the talks today about Wendy Silk modeling leaf growth dynamics and the fact that she started out with a river and was worried about how many fish were swimming by. I had seen that analogy a time or two, and it took me a while to understand the continuity equation to the same degree that I do now. But I wanted to point out again how powerful it is and how very valuable it has been to have a mathematical component helping us understand what's happening in a growth zone. It's that insight that makes the biology happen and help us understand what the biology is. And I reflect back while I was listening to her talk in the fact that we were trying to come up with some sort of an assessment. I'm sure it would not have been so sophisticated or well thought out. But I oftentimes remind myself, sometimes it's easier to read the literature than to run the experiment yourself. And Wendy pointed that out very clearly. And there are other areas that she's researching, particularly the ideas on curvature and growth regulation and how leaves are shaped. And these are things that we have to take into consideration as well. I'm not so sure that if I were to try to sell a new variety of tall fescue because it had bubbly leaves, I would get very far. I think the farmers would be much more interested in something that's twisted, but they would wonder why. And I would be able to explain that to them. But fortunately, most of the tall fescue leaves are flat, but still they have to grow in width and they have to be out there and suspended in certain ways. Leaf habit is something that's really interesting, and the analogy with kelp was particularly interesting. Francois Gastal talked about leaf elongation and some of the things that were happening as you added nitrogen to the system. I reflect back myself to those original studies that we did and the things that we learned by that process. For a long time, we've recognized that nitrogen is an important component in a growth process. And now I wonder if we could translate some of that, not only looking at nitrate and some of the things, but what about the legume association and how much nitrogen comes from the legume and can be transferred, and we get the similar response from that as we get from direct applications. The concept that you raised about the impact of nitrogen on the epidermal cells and the mesophyll cells is another interesting thing that came out. And why the differential in the way that the cells are responding when they're growing in close proximity tells me something about the mysteries of biology, and that we don't understand everything until we get to the cellular level. And we're hopeful that our molecular biology friends will continue to remind us of that, not just by verbiage, but by presenting good experiments that demonstrate it. If we go on to Marie and her interesting talk on fructan, and little did I know that that would ever end up to the same position it is as she brought it in her lab. Very intriguing, because Professor Nosberger and I talked a lot about these things some 25 years ago, but we didn't have the tools. But the new tools are coming, and you've taken advantage of that to put them into use, and I'm very impressed. Similar with Francois, he's following along with some of these thoughts on breeding and using QTLs, etc., and what things are happening, and the fact that the breeders can offer a tremendous amount to us. But the fructan story is one that needs meaning, and it's one that I think is really important. And as Hans was talking about some of the things he was talking about in bioenergetics and the fact that there's a role for reserve carbohydrates even in a steady state, I'm reminded of many discussions we've had as to what is the bioenergetics of fructan biosynthesis and hydrolysis. Is it a costly process compared to starch biosynthesis and hydrolysis? And is that really a mechanistic advantage to the plant at low temperatures when respiration may be a factor in continuing to keep the plant going, particularly when we know that they're well adapted to low temperatures? The dual labeling technique that Hans pointed out points again that leaf growth is not a process that's limited by one factor. We need to deal with the issue in a complex sense of both nitrogen and carbon, and probably water, because it's an interesting thing as well. When he started his remarks about the high concentration of sucrose, I was reminded of a long discussion we had when John Boyer came to Missouri one time, and Hans asked him, could the water that's used in the development of the cell, in other words, the water content that had to come in to cause the elongation process, is it such that its sucrose concentration is high enough that it will maintain the number of fish going under the bridge in that particular cell? Well, we argued a lot and ended up getting over into something on whether or not the water uptake into the cell was passive or active and a few other things like that. But it goes to show that it's an integrated system and one that we have to keep in mind as we look along at the various things that are progressing. I've got oversights. Clearly, there are a lot of things that we should have done that we didn't do. And there were some things that we did that we shouldn't have done. I spent a lot of time on photosynthesis, and I'm still interested in it, because the purpose of creating a grass leaf blade is twofold as far as I'm concerned. One is an animal food, and the other is an interceptor of radiation. And I don't want to lose sight of the fact that that leaf is going to have to provide those two functions in a grass plant that's used in a forage sense. So we need to be aware of how the leaf is constructed to make it the best possible animal food, as well as the best possible photosynthetic unit. And not losing sight of those two things is important. But it's also helpful to understand that when these folks are doing all these studies on growth development, there are others that are interested in those, and it would have been interesting to head a broader, even, coverage of this particular topic. Going on and wishes and so on, it's been a pleasure to be surrounded by groups of students, and I don't have them all, but some, just to show you that there was a group there. Every one of those folks contributed in a way that was unique. And the interactions that they brought to the table and the discussions and the arguments and sometimes challenges for me were all very inspiring. And that's only a small group of that went through. And of course, John Couch there in the middle was part of that program throughout. And another group came, and another group. But it was those students that kept on coming, I'm finished now, but did the work and brought the new ideas and kept the challenges in front of us. And to that extent, I'm very, very grateful for what they were able to do. The amazing thing is we always tried to keep it simple. We tried to work it in a way that we knew we could do something. It was interesting to see the way that, Wendy, you were measuring the flex in the leaves. You'd cobbled up the microscope slides and put a ruler there that was probably a gift from some chemical company. But we did about the same thing, and using razor blades and pins and magic markers wherever we could. But if we could keep it simple, we knew that the ideas were going to be there, and it's how we got them done. But we're very fortunate also to have a group of students from Dave Sleeper, particularly, working on things. And they were very effective in manipulating the genetics of photosynthesis. Unfortunately, we did not get to the point where we're doing the genetics on leaf growth. And I was really pleased to hear the efforts that are going on in Lusignan and with the group on the fructan to try to get back at the genetic role on these things. Additional concerns and needs. The leaf width issue is always one, because we argue about the elongation rate, which is important, but width also contributes a great deal to the leaf area. And you saw some discussion about it in Francois in his presentation about leaf width, and Jennifer has challenged me many times about different ways that leaf width can be regulated. I think we've probably got enough data in the files so we could probably calculate a few of these things and find out what goes on, not the regulation, but at least where leaf width is primarily affected. Still bothers me that we've got cell division of the mesophyll cells, cell wall to cell wall with expansion of the epidermal cells. Clearly there have to be plasmodesmata of some sort. We've seen them in the microscope. There's got to be communication. But how we're starting to deal with the issues that really get at what causes this cell to divide and this cell to elongate, and yet they're in proximity, is a real challenge. And I really hope that we can get down to the bottom here and say some things relative to the molecular biology and what they can tell us. But I'm pleased that we're getting to the cellular level in some of these things. The airspace has always been a dilemma. If you read the literature, you think there should be a lot of airspace to reduce the resistances that are going on inside of a leaf. At the same time, if you have a lot of airspace, you don't have very much mesophyll space. And we need to think in terms of how we're going to construct a leaf that's really going to match those two up, and I think that's a very important component as we look at it, particularly relative to the photosynthetic machinery. Stomatal density is another area. And it's interesting as we look at the way that the leaf develops, and we've got some papers on this, that for a long time the cell division process is such that it's linear with the way that the leaf is growing. But the stomatal development puts the cell division the other direction, so we get periclinal instead of anaclinal divisions, and it's an interesting concept. What is that little particular thing that regulates it, and how important are the stomata in this whole effort? I'd like to see some potentials on molecular biology expanded. Now, unfortunately, tall fescue is a hexaploid, and most plant breeder genetics people get very upset about working with polyploids in molecular biology. But maybe we can tease those things down and look at the diploid level in some things to get the principles working out, and then bring that back up to the higher polyploid levels if we needed to. But we need to understand those. And there was some discussion today about growth regulators, and I only reflect on that indirectly because I too have thought about growth regulators, but have been stymied. At one time, we were very interested in the cytokinins and the regulation of cell division. But how do you study the cytokinins? And the methodology was very poor at the time. They're moving those things along, and the molecular biology people can help us understand and evaluate and determine what's happening. But every time we turn around the cytokinins and discuss it, there's another growth regulator that affects that. And so Bob Sharp and I did a little bit of work even using ABA and analyzing it in a leaf growth zone to try to understand what would happen. But ABA is influenced by ethylene and a few other things. So I leave with that particular component back and saying, well, sometime time will change and we'll be able to get at the growth regulators and understand what their role may be. But for the time being, I'm reminded of a discussion I had several years ago. And we were discussing growth and so on, and we had an eminent scientist who I won't name Maybe I should. And we were talking about this thing, and someone said, well, what about oxen? And he jumped up and he said, you just ended the argument. If you're talking about a process physiologically and someone brings up growth regulators, it ends the argument because you can't argue because you don't know enough about them. And he was right. That stopped. Well, they might be involved. Terminate. That's it. So by default or by practice, we tend to avoid the growth regulators and we study the other things that are going on. But somewhere in there, we know they have a role. But we have to get it unraveled and understand it. Additional concerns, I transfer this around to the tiller basis. Why are there two leaves growing at a time in a tall fescue tiller or a perennial ryegrass tiller? There's one that's about half grown and the other one is just coming out and collaring and the next one starts. I read a paper that was submitted. I don't know for sure if it's going to get published or not. It had a little bit of a flaw in it. But they were suggesting that temperature regulation on some C3 grasses is reflected in having more than two leaves growing at a time. Now we know in C4s, oftentimes you get three or four, five, six leaves growing at a time. Now we've always argued about Jonathan Swift and his ideas that great is the man who can make two leaves grow where only one grew before. I don't think historically he had very much botanical sense when he was talking about that. But nevertheless, that is a concept. And why are we stymied with some of these leaves? Now I know they're conservative in their carbon use and the way that they're growing, and one of the main goals is persistence, and they can do that. But what happens here, and why can't we increase that like they have in the C4s? What regulates the phylochron? In other words, the number of days it takes to make a leaf is another question that comes up. We don't understand that. And what is the cost of tiller formation? Oftentimes we think, well, if we have this grass plant growing and it puts one leaf here and one leaf here, there's an axillary bud at the base of each of them, let's just form a tiller and we can get two leaves growing at one time, or four. But what is the cost of that tiller development? And what percentage of the tillers that actually get started to develop necessarily survive? It's well over, sometimes depending on the density, it can go anywhere from 10% to almost 100% of the tillers are initiated, die, initiated and die. And I come back to the point that Francois was mentioning about the light quality and the red, far red relationships and the blue light effects as they're penetrating down through a canopy. And what causes that tiller to survive or not survive? And what can we do about it? Why only three leaves per tiller? We've studied senescence and tried to figure out if we could keep more than three leaves. Now, C4 grass can keep more than three leaves. I've seen six and seven of them on a lot of these C4 grasses. But the cool season grasses, particularly those that have a very strong vernalization requirement and only flower once, normally have three leaves. The fourth leaf appears and the youngest one or oldest one dies back. I don't know for sure what it is, but we need to understand if we could save that leaf, it'd be a great, great advantage. Why does that fourth leaf senesce? And we translate back up then to the canopy. Wendy talked a little bit about leaf angles, and boy, I don't want to get into the pulvinus and the collar and all the commotion of how we're going to angle those leaves and get the stress and the strain. I had trouble enough mathematically with the continuity equation without getting into all those things, Wendy, but you keep training that next group of scientists so they can study this and understand how they can address this leaf angle and get the light penetration so that the red, far red lights, so on, are at the right wavelengths to keep those tillers and other things going. A lot of discussion about blades, but not very much discussion about the sheath. Now we heard a lot about it in the discussion with the fructan storage in the sheath and how important they are. But John Hodgson asked me several years ago, why don't you try to work with a grass plant that makes a longer sheath? I said, well, why would you do that? And he said, because that's the part that controls the closeness of grazing. If we have a sheath that's X centimeters long, most of the animals would graze down to that sheath height. Now, if we could increase that sheath height, that would mean that the animals wouldn't graze as closely. There may be a better opportunity for legumes to persist. There may be more openings in the canopy if it didn't tiller very much that would allow other plants, so the competitiveness would change. On the other hand, if you wanted to graze it closely, drop that sheath down. But we don't understand very much about how the sheath grows. We know when it grows, but we don't understand a lot about how it grows. And that's another important point. And it comes back not only to the behavior of the ruminants, but also to the elongation rates and so on plant competitiveness and what it does with legumes and weeds. And maybe the fundamental question, the one that I go back a long time to and I've never been able to answer, is how many days does a leaf have to grow before it can repay the plant for its own synthesis? In other words, we get the leaf into a positive carbon situation. Well, I'm hopeful that some of the research that these folks have been doing that we've discussed today will lead to that answer. We tried taking a look at it, but we weren't integrating enough things together at the time, so we did not have a good answer. And in fact, Jeff and I did some calculations once on part of his thesis in order to come up with some answers, but that's a while ago. So where do we go? Almost 40 years, on Saturday mornings, my students would always meet. 9 o'clock, coffee, napkins, talk. The keys are still the same. You'd be a good observer, read the literature, develop sound hypotheses, and by all means, discuss the data with peers, because they look at things differently, and they raise different questions, and they make you think harder, and you do better experiments. So I reflect back, and I recognize that there's a complexity. And we've been trying to integrate these things together today, and looking at the way that the grass leaf grows, and reflecting back on the things that we have learned and others are learning, and I'm just so pleased about that. But it's a highly integrated system, and one that I couldn't even get all the things into one figure. But we look at carbon, we look at nitrogen, we look at water, we look at temperature, we look at water stress, we look at solar energy and the wavelengths that are coming up. The conclusion that I have, I wrote this a while back, the perennial grass plant is a highly integrated system that is well buffered after centuries of holding the soil, embracing the sunshine, surviving the climate, and enduring the disruption of its harmony by disrespectful herbivores. Although I will make some progress, my appreciation of its complexity far exceeds my understanding of its detail. And with that, I'm leaving the book open for a lot more scientists and a lot more students to dig out the detail and help reduce that complexity. It's been a great afternoon for me. One that I never really thought about ever occurring, let alone participating in. But it's been fun. And occasionally, we catch a guy sleeping. But there are two folks that I know spent a lot of time working on this. And Jennifer and Jeff and John Couch, the fellow that's been working with me for 40 years, since the day I arrived at Missouri almost. We formed teams, we've had a great time, and today has been one of them. And I thank you all very, very much. Thank you.